Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, here every Wednesday and Friday at 5 p.m. And with
me... And I'm Heidi Morales Ryan.
Awesome. Very good. We're getting slick.
Oh, yeah. I've been slick. You just don't shut up.
We are both here every Wednesday and Friday bringing you American Hit Radio. And on Wednesdays, we normally look at what I consider the decade anniversary shows, where we go back 10, 20, or 30 years from whatever the date is to give you some music history. Now, you probably know that we've been doing that for a while. That's what we normally do on Wednesdays. And today's show is pretty much the same, but we got some catching up to do, Heidi.
The same yet different.
Exactly. You know, in the latter part of last year, we did an awful lot of shows in the 50s and the 60s. And then there were a few specialty shows. And I figured that we'd be able to catch up sometime in like maybe November and December and cover the parts of the 70s, for example, that we had missed. And there were so many specialty shows between interviews and end of year things. And then, of course, we missed a few because we were on vacation that we didn't really get a chance to go back and cover the 70s. And when I looked at the list,
and that's a huge travesty.
Yeah, we missed like an entire almost a half a year. So I want to cover singles from the last part of 1978 that were basically just hitting the charts at that time, so that these are essentially the songs that you would have been hearing on a regular basis. What is it, 30 years ago now? 30 years ago this month.
Yes.
Songs that were released in the latter part of 1978, but were very actively on the charts.
Well, all I'm saying is it better be good, Ryan.
Yeah, not all of it is. In fact, my goodness, that's kind of what my point is here. The late 70s, the pop charts began to they melted, essentially. Things just began to fall apart pretty drastically. And I've got a bunch of songs that... are meant to represent
that. Is Disco Duck on there?
That was a little earlier.
Oh.
But for what it's worth, in the scope of things, you're really not that far off from what things were like in 1970. So let's take a look at the good, the bad, the ugly, and the just plain in between. We'll start by reminiscing with the Little River Band.
Hurry up! Looking at songs that debuted on the pop charts in the latter part of 1978 and were still being getting lots of airplay in January of 1979, 30 years ago this month. That's what we're doing, and that was the Australian band, Little River Band.
It's got that smooth jazz feel.
You know, I'm not ashamed to say that I like the song. I'm not ashamed
at
all.
I'm proud of you.
You know what? I think it's a nice romantic song. It's a song that I was convinced when I was younger, when it came out that I heard it, that I'm going to hear that song when I'm older, and it's going to make me all teary.
Yeah.
And it probably will. I'm not that old yet.
It hasn't happened yet.
Not yet.
But you're working on it.
I'm still liking it. I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of, you know, schlocky stuff that really doesn't have any chance of ever having an effect on me.
It reminds me a little of Steely Dan, which I am not a big fan of, but you are.
Yeah, okay. You know, I could see that. It's a little bit smoother in that sense, because I don't think Steely Dan ever quite... Steely Dan eventually became like a smooth jazz band, but this is where we were at in early 1979, late 1978. The big pop band of that time was the Cars. And I wrote this about them, so I could just read this right out of...
I don't think you liked the Cars.
Oh, I did. I did. But I, you know, I'll read what I wrote about them, and
okay.
You can more or less determine it from there, because I had a take on the Cars.
Yes. Okay.
The Cars are the band that laminated punk rock. They looked like punks, only spiffier. They sounded like punks, only shinier. They took punk's rough-edged simplicity and put a glossy sheen around it that made it more presentable. Underneath the airtight seal, the punk suffocated. In its place was a corporatized calling card called New Wave. By making punk more palatable, the Cars were rewarded with record company support, radio airplay, and ultimately mass acceptance, while their brethren, who remained true to punk's idealism, sank into commercial oblivion.
They also got rewarded with supermodel wives.
That too. Absolutely. Cars' debut album was an undeniable amalgam of dumb lyrics and brilliant riffs, produced to perfection by Roy Thomas Baker. He's the same guy who produced Bohemian Rhapsody for Queen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to wonder why that album sounded so clean and crisp, you can thank Roy Thomas Baker pretty much for that. With an attention to detail that was not at all apposite to the tenets of punk rock, the sound of the Cars was completely in line with mid-70s corporate rock, except for those lyrics. This is where I come up with my own opinion mm-hmm. about the Cars, because I laugh hysterically when it was. If you ever listen to the words of a Cars song,
yeah, you want to brush my rock and roll hair,
right? Rick Ocasek came up with rhymes that, in comparison, he made the Ramones sound like Rhodes Scholars to me. These are just a few gems written by Rick Ocasek. Let the good times roll. Let them make you a clown. Let them leave you up in the air. Let them brush your rock and roll hair. Good. How about, life's the same, I'm moving in stereo. Life's the same, except for my shoes. You've got your nuclear boots and your drip-dry glove. And when you bite your lip, it's some reaction to love. He's like, what? He actually wrote this. And people ate it up. And you know what's really funny? You hear a song enough, you sing along with it, you love every word. It doesn't mean a thing after a while. It's just the sound of the syllables that matter.
It's abstract poetry set to music, okay?
Now, you add to the weirdness of these words the fact that both the singers, lead Ocasek, the main songwriter, and Ben Orr, had a quaver in their voice that made it difficult to tell them apart. They both sounded almost identical on record. Both of them sound as though they learned to sing by watching Katharine Hepburn movies. They got that same quaver in their voice. For example, it's Orr who sings Just What I Needed, while it's Rick Ocasek who sings Best Friend's Girl. Play them back to back, you would know that they were two different people. But it is. Supporting their oral jello is the extremely confident and stunning guitar work of Elliot Easton and the granite-hard rhythm of drummer Dave Robinson, with the new wave noodling of keyboardist Greg Hawkes filling out the lineup. From that debut album, The Cars, here is the first big hit from the album entitled Just What I Needed.
In your hair, I don't mind you coming here.
It's one of those songs where the production is so perfect and it's so easy to sing along to that you don't even think about it, you just enjoy it. But Heidi, let me ask you, can you tell me the words of the chorus of that song? I guess you're just what I needed.
Needed someone to please. I needed someone to bleed. I needed someone to tease.
I'm almost positive. I guess you're just what I needed. I needed someone to feed. I guess you're just what I needed. I needed someone to bleed. Because feed and bleed rhyme.
Right.
Yeah, unbelievable. That's fine. You know what? At least it was a good song compared to like what else was going on in around this time on the pop charts. Because up next, there are a couple of great misses or just plain bad hits. And picking bad pop songs from the late 70s is like
shooting fish in a barrel.
It is. It's like shooting fish in a barrel or trying to hit the side of a barn while standing inside the barn. It's just too easy. There's just so much stuff that is ridiculous. And I mean, some people will disagree with me on this one. Maybe some people will consider this to be a great mess. It's very possible because Barry Manilow was quite huge around this time. And some of his stuff is more palatable than others. I find this song to be a bit ludicrous myself, but be that as it may, I wanted to represent the times accurately, which means you've got to play a song like this to convey what music was like 30 years ago on the pop charts. Because what was happening was people like Barry Manilow singing songs like Copacabana. Oops, I'm sorry. I got to play track 3 to make this. Actually, you know what we can do? It's okay. Let's let this go in the background because I'm playing bad tracks, and it doesn't get much worse than this anyway. This was my other great miss. So we can talk over this one a little bit, and then we'll let it come back up. Remember Miko? The theme from Star Wars and the themes from Close Encounters and all that stuff. This is Miko, who was still making hits in 1979. You know, the weird thing is history isn't so shameless. He was responsible for writing the arrangement for A Crystal Blue Persuasion by Tommy James and the Shondells.
Right.
That's respectable.
That is respectable.
He was in a jazz trio with Chuck Mangione and Ron Carter. Now, you know, that's pretty darn respectable as well. It's just like eventually what ended up happening after he saw that George Lucas film. It
affected him profoundly.
It ruined all of our lives. Because he came out of there and he made the most incredibly cheesy disco arrangement of theme from Star Wars that became a number one hit for him in 77. And on the back of that success,
all those disco kids loved it.
Yeah, that's just, and you know, because exactly, the disco kids were loving it and dancing to it. So on the heels of that, of course you had to do another one for Close Encounters when that was the follow-up big, you know, blockbuster movie.
Yeah.
And I guess he was just on a roll. So here he is in 1978 doing the same thing for The Wizard of Oz. Believe it or not. So I'll just let this roll by because I think it's fairly incredible. Here's Miko with themes from The Wizard of Oz. Stunning. It's just so amazing.
I think that was the birth of the club kid in New York City.
Yeah?
I don't know.
The whole club thing was happening way before. I mean, Studio 54 was,
yeah,
you know, the kids
that like to dress all whacked out. And
I don't know who it was. I don't know who would line up to buy a theme from The Wizard of Oz. Or themes.
from The Wizard of Oz. That was his third big hit, though. I mean, there was the Star Wars theme Cantina Band thing, which was a number one hit. That was huge. He followed that up with the theme from Close Encounters. That went to number 25. And then that last travesty that we had just heard.
I bet you a lot of fabulous people were really into it.
And those same fabulous people probably bought this as well. The song that I meant to play by, by Barry Manilow earlier. Here's Copacabana.
Copacabana, music and passion were always the
There's a treat, huh? The full unedited version.
I think we had that when I was a kid. The neighbors gave it to my dad.
Of Copacabana by Barry Manilow. Obviously a big hit for him. And a song that really goes a long way toward defining pop music in that era 30 years ago.
So many people fell in love.
You know, right? You had an interesting story. You should tell that story real quickly if you could.
My ex-sister-in-law who got engaged by Barry Manilow, is that the way to say it? She was at his show.
She was a big fan or something.
Yeah, she loved Barry Manilow. I think she still does.
Now she's obviously like a bit of a punker though too, right? So there must have been something ironic about it. But
kind of London punk kind of gal. But her husband, or soon to be betrothed, wanted to find the most special way that he could to propose to her. And Barry was performing in New Orleans, and a friend of ours served him at a restaurant and asked if he would announce their engagement at the show. And he did.
How'd that go down? They were just sitting in their seats?
Yeah, they were way up high, and he starts telling the story about this couple that were very much in love, and he was from New Orleans, and she was from London, and all of a sudden she was thinking, wow, that sounds so much like Pat and I. You know?
The light bulb's beginning to go off, yeah.
And then all of a sudden he says, and will Pat and Justine please come down here? And he brings them all the way to the front of the stage and introduces them to the audience and puts chairs in front, and everybody that had brought flowers for Barry then gave them all to her.
Oh, that's so
really beautiful.
That is so cute.
That's clapped.
He's another guy. I mean, you hear nothing but nice things about him. He seems like he's the nicest guy. He's totally aware of his campy image. He plays it up brilliantly. It's hard to dislike him. No matter what you think about his music, it seems like he really is
right.
A nice guy. So in a lot of ways, he deserves the fame that he got, I feel, as it is. So that's totally
great
cool.
Great guy.
Now, in the exact other direction, I mean, there were so many things that were happening. In 1978, pop music was basically like a shrapnel bomb. Everything was so diverse. You're dealing with punk and disco coexisting at the exact same time, and the weird byproducts of the things that would come out of these two things coexisting at the same time. They're fundamental opposites almost in so many ways. So it was a weird time for pop music. And one band that was feeling some of the negative impact of all of this was The Who. Obviously, you think about this now, 1965 was when The Who was probably at their peak. You got this, you can get that image in your head maybe of the very, of the young Pete Townsend, or even more likely a better picture.
Yeah, smashing their instruments, very rock and roll.
Yeah, think of like the young Keith Moon. He looked like a child.
Oh,
back then,
awesome.
You know, it was incredible. And he had this crazy energy and everything else. But by 1977, 1978, Keith had put on a lot of weight. His reputation as being a madman is still totally intact, but he's just not able to play the way that he used to because he's now lumbering. He's just a big lumbering guy. And punk came along. Was the first thing that the punks started to do was label the old rock and roll bands as dinosaurs. So the biggest dinosaurs of all really were The Who. Because they were the band that just wouldn't die, it seemed. They just wouldn't go away, and they weren't really adapting to anything. And you took one look at what was happening to Keith Moon. Keith Moon knew that. He just knew that his days were numbered, it seemed. There were stories that I've heard where he was talking to Roger Daltrey, where he was like basically almost in tears because he just knew that he's never going to get his youth back again. And Roger just didn't know what to even say to it. It was like he had this insight as to where things really were for him.
Right.
And that it might have had—
Never mind going to the gym—
Taking right.
off some of the poundage.
Well, you know, it was, you know, he basically painted himself into a corner by being the rock and roll clown that he was. And he really didn't want to let that go because that was his identity more than anything.
Right. He didn't have the capability of reinventing himself.
Right.
Like, say, David Bowie has done a million times.
Right. You know, Keith was Keith.
And
the weird thing about it is, like, for the album, the Who Are You album, the cover shot that was taken, Keith Moon, you know, they're basically on a stage set, and Keith Moon just pulls, he's wearing like a riding crop thing, and I remember he just, in the shot, he pulls up to a regular stage chair, and he's sitting in the chair backward, like leaning on where you would normally have your back. He's sitting backward on the chair, and painted on the front of the chair, it says, "Not to be taken away." And no sooner had the album come out than that's exactly what did happen. Keith Moon had died, and he was taken away. And it was just sad that that would have gone down like that, the irony of it. And the biggest irony of all was like really came from Pete Townsend's lyrics, where he was addressing this more or less obliquely what was happening with him in punk. Like I said, you know, the song, Who Are You, from my perspective, hearing it after all these years, is essentially about fame and identity from the perspective of an artist who is perceived as a dinosaur by the punks. He's a guy who's going out at night, trying to keep maintain his own relevance, getting totally loaded, drinking way too much, collapsing in doorways. A cop finds him, wakes him up and says, I'll let you go home if you can. And then it forces Townsend to basically realize that he's recognized because he's famous. And then he asks himself the question that anybody at that point in their life would have to ask themselves ultimately, which is the title of the song, Who Are You? midst of punk, Pete Townshend having an identity crisis. That's The Who, of course, singing Who Were You? Another, the unedited version, the full length as opposed to the edited single version. We were looking at music from 30 years ago, songs that were on the pop charts around this time, and you can see it's a real mixed bag, boy. There's so many different things that are going on at the same time. Like I said, you know, with these different disparate types of sounds all competing for the same space.
Right. I think my favorite's been Barry Manilow.
Well, this actually falls closer to that genre. But I would say significantly cooler. One of the biggest bands to come out of the whole Studio 54 thing was the band Chic. They had so many.
Le Freak, say Chic?
Exactly. So let's just play it here. Chic, Le Freak.
Freak out! Freak out!
You know, just in the four or five songs that we played, it already paints such an accurate picture of what the diversity, the weird diversity was like in 1970, as 1978 faded into 1979, 30 years ago. Of course, that is the band, the group Chic. Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards, the main songwriters, with La Freak, a song that became a number one hit for 6 solid weeks, 6 weeks in a row. That's a pretty big hit for 1970, you know, for the late 70s.
Well, it's a great song when you're that high, so.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, it still sounds kind of cool in its own way. It's one of those songs that grew on me after a few decades.
After a few hits.
In the 70s, it didn't really do much. You know, booze.
Yeah.
You know, just on a personal level, maybe this is as good a time as any. First of all, I should mention that if you're interested in our show and you want to see it on the internet, you can check us out at our website. Go to AmericanHitRadio.com, AmericanHitNetwork.com. All of our shows are posted there. You can check them out. You can find the entire series as well at our archive site, which is Shut Up and Listen, shadduplisten.com. So you can go to either of those sites and check out. They're all play on demand. Just click on them here whenever you want to.
We should do a video stream.
Oh, yeah, that is, well, just to, like, do like an Imus thing where we film ourselves?
Yeah.
We're all good looking enough.
Yeah, right. It'll give me an incentive to lose some weight at least.
That would make me so paranoid. Oh, really? I'd be so paranoid if there was a video stream on here. Yeah.
Extreme close up.
That would weird me out.
Freak out.
By the way, I could also mention if you know our show, you probably know that we also do a Friday show, which is American Hit Radio Continued. We call it the How Music Changed series, and we're in the middle of a
presented
Motown.
Presented by Tommy Hilfiger.
Yeah.
Tell them what you're doing on Saturday.
Yeah, I should do that. That's a good idea. We got a big show. My group has got a really big show coming up on Saturday. It's one of the biggest, most interesting things we do. It's an Elvis tribute, which might sound, you know, a bit
for
simple.
A good cause.
Superficially, it's just like Elvis tribute. So what? Well, what it is it's my band, the Blackguards, with, oh boy, about, I think right now there's about 6 or 7 other bands that are playing that are going to be doing a few songs as well. We've got something like maybe 25 guest vocalists. Essentially what it is everybody comes up. It's a variety show where somebody comes up, performs a song. Then the next person comes up, performs their number. And we just keep moving through the different acts and the different singers and everything else. And this goes on and on. And I would say we've got a good, solid 3 hours of entertainment, maybe longer. This might be the longest Elvis show we've had in a while coming up. And it's all this Saturday at Matty T's in Comac, 9:00.
Elvis forever.
So I would say, you know, come
as you are
with as many people as
that's
you
not
like.
Not Elvis song. That's Nirvana.
No.
But come early because honestly, this show often sells out. In fact, the last time we
last couple times
we did this, it did sell out. People were not able to get
people
in.
People were turned away at the door.
And I have a feeling it's going to be even more popular this year. There's just so many people that are involved.
And all the proceeds go to?
It's all for
the Elvis Foundation.
Rock and Roll.
Yeah, Rock and Roll. It's basically
a food bank.
Exactly.
It's a Long Island food bank.
Long Island food bank where the money is raised from basically rock and roll type of things like this. And all the money that we save is going to be donated to them. If you come, can you please bring a can or two of food? That'd be totally cool. That's
non-perishable items.
Something non-perishable that can be used and distributed.
I bought some macaroni and cheese to give.
That works brilliantly. You know, you got something to do with that. If you got that pumpkin pie stuffing in your closet that you haven't used for about 60, they haven't used this Thanksgiving, bring it. You know, why not? A couple cans of tuna fish would be great. Awesome.
Yeah, yes.
You get the idea. And I promise it's going to be a load of fun. A lot of really entertaining. You know, we're doing a rehearsal tonight. Immediately after this show, I got to go home to about 30 people at my house where we're going to rehearse a whole bunch of these songs with the singers, get the choreography down. I mean, we got the whole thing down. We got the Jordanaires thing happening. We got the background singers.
Don't give away the whole show.
It's just, you got to come in and see what's this going to be. There's a lot happening.
What's going to be?
If you build it, they will come.
Right. So there it is.
Okay.
This Saturday at Matty T's.
Back to business, young man.
Matty T's on Comac Road in Comac this Saturday, January 24th, about 9 p.m. starting time. So there you have it. Meanwhile, where were we? 30 years ago? Discussed the music from then? Yeah, something like that. We got
to
get back to the great bisses. I mean, we just played some disco stuff. And this is exactly what happened, I think, is that disco, a lot of people complained about how disco is going to ruin music. And I don't think the problem was that disco itself was bad. I think the problem was that a lot of artists otherwise talented artists jumped onto the disco bandwagon and made fools out of themselves by trying to go disco, and they pretty much raped their own sense of credibility. One of the people who did it, I think, worse than anybody was Rod Stewart. He just basically, I mean, he was a guy who I had such incredible, in the early 70s, one of the best albums of all time that he had released, actually with the Faces, Not as Good as a Wink to a Blind Horse, is fantastic. Every Picture Tells a Story, his solo album, is about as good as rock music can get. Those albums are fantastic.
And then?
Here it is just like 7 years later, 5-6 years later, and he's putting out stuff like this. Here's Rod Stewart singing with the ultimate bad hit.
Do we
in my
have
opinion.
To?
Do you think
I'm sexy?
I'm too sexy for my girl.
We'll be right back.
Rod Stewart, Do You Think I'm Sexy? And a lot of people apparently
they
did.
They did.
That song sold in the bazillion. It's still played all the time. So
do you know what chart position that had?
It was huge. I just turned the page.
I'm sorry.
So I don't know. But it was big. You know what the thing about it is? Like, you know, I'm playing it now totally with a totally ironic perspective, and it's being played probably at another station right here on Long Island at the exact same time with no irony attached whatsoever.
Oh, no, they are super excited to play it for you.
I know, it's really incredible.
I loved KMFDM's cover of that song.
Yeah, KMFDM.
I thought that was pretty hilarious.
That was a really bizarre, you know, monster version of it. And since we're talking about bad disco from this era, I got to play with this song because this is just the ultimate in bad hits from this era. It's just we're playing bad songs. We may as well get this one in too as quickly as we can.
Okay.
Leif Garrett on the pop charts. Remember Leif? You probably still see him.
I saw him in an in-store.
Is that right?
Really?
Yep.
Oh, man.
I went with my neighbor girls.
He's one of these guys that they show on TV now, like the before and after picture. I just go, oh, my God.
Right.
What happened to him? Oh, what
sadness.
Here he was. Behind the music.
Here he was, you know, in his grand leafness. Leif Garrett singing.
Pre-leafness?
A do run run.
No, that was Sean Cassidy.
Oh, darn.
I know all this stuff.
Wow.
Leif, however, sang this entitled, I Was Made for Dancing.
For dancing all?
Not really.
All night long.
It's a disco track by Leif Garrett, but it also sounds like, doesn't it sound like European or something, like it's like from Russia or something?
It sounds like something you'd hear after somebody at a soccer game scored a goal.
Yeah, it's just,
I don't know, I think.
Whatever. But, you know, I had a lot of fun today, even though we got a chance to play a lot of great misses. Got a lot of phone calls today, so I want to thank everyone for calling us up and staying in touch. And we hope you can join us again on Friday when we continue our How Music Changed look at every Motown A-side coming up this Friday. So let's leave you with the band that we started our show with, actually, or near the beginning of the show anyway. It was the biggest album from this time 30 years ago. So let's play the other hit track, this time not featuring Ben Orr, but featuring the main singer-songwriter Rick Ocasek. Here's The Cars from their title debut album, another hit entitled My Best Friend's Girl. Take care, everyone. See you Friday.
Bye-bye.
Surprise. Here she comes again.